In my first talk, I discussed, or rather presented, the four functions of mythology as I have conceived of them: the metaphysical function of opening up the ultimate mystery, the cosmological function, the sociological function, and the psychological. Now, for 2 days, I discussed one way or another, essentially, the metaphysical function, which is a function that mythology must begin to serve after one has passed the midpoint of life, when you are losing your linkage to the social context. Then you have to find a base, and it is this that the metaphysical imagery furnishes. The second set of days, I was talking largely about the psychological function, which has to do with the shift from the period of dependency to the period of responsibility in midlife, and then the passage from that to the metaphysical function. Now, of these four functions, the first and the fourth are fairly constant in human experience. The metaphysical problem remains what it is, no matter where you are. There are different ways of answering it, but the problem remains. And the psychological function is always conditioned by the character of human biology. When, however, we turn to the cosmological and sociological functions, we have a great transformation through history. And what I want to talk about this morning and this afternoon are the main stages in these transformations. When one regards in the grand long reach of time the history of mythologies and of mankind who supports and gives birth to them, one finds two great crises, absolutely traumatic, you might say, as far as the myths are concerned. The first is that of the coming into being of the planting and agriculturally based societies. Before that, we have essentially small nomadic wandering tribes, which may be more or less large, but are largely nomadic, and their sustenance is gained by food gathering, by foraging, by hunting. These are the people that I think properly can be called the primitive people, the primitive mythologies, and it's those I want to speak about this morning. The second great crisis of transformation takes place in relatively recent times, since the Renaissance, with the invention, or with the discovery, of the scientific method of research, a programmatic, controlled method of searching out the mysteries of nature and judging, and the invention of the power-driven machine. The power-driven machine, no matter what the power, has totally transformed man's consciousness and man's world control. And with this, we have the modern period. From this, there has come the erasure of all culture horizons. Up to very recently, culture horizons could be, what were inevitably there, and could be maintained. Now, with particularly air travel and such, it's impossible to hold them together. Where you don't have a horizon, you cannot have a homogeneous mythology. The area there and possibility for folk mythologies, self-standing and controlling everybody within an environment, no longer can be maintained. I have used the term in some of my writings, a mythogenetic zone, a zone of experience in which a mythology can be generated. Such a zone must be one in which all of the inhabitants, or at least the great majority of the inhabitants, will be having comparable experiences, so that the same imagery, or one system of imagery, will be having controllable effects on everybody within the social context. But where you have a world like our own, where there is no control of environments. People come from totally different backgrounds, have totally different geographical experiences. They have the experience of the whole globe. And through TV and so forth now, experiences of environments you'll never experience. And yet the images of these environments are, they become engrams, they're imprinted on youngsters sitting before the TV. There is no geographical mythogenetic zone. My notion of the present mythogenetic zone is the heart and spirit of each individual. He has his own, and it's based on his own engrams and images, and these are what you discover in your dreams. So what I'm going to be reviewing now are the main mythogenetic zones and moments and modes of the past up to the present moment. The first period, I will, I think the term primitive fits very well. And it dates, of course, from the emergence of the human psyche to the coming of agriculture, agriculturally based societies. The period of that crisis, the emergence of agriculture, is now placed by the archaeologists at about 9,500 BC. The period for the emergence of mankind is being pushed back by leaps and bounds every year. When I started my series of books called The Mass of God some 13 years ago, the origins of mankind were placed at a date around 600,000 BC. They are now placed at a date about 1,800,000 BC by the discoveries of Leakey in the Olduvai Gorge of East Africa, Northeast Africa. Man emerged and grew up for nearly 2 million years as a ranging, hunting creature, and that is what built our bodies. Then about 9,500 BC, in the Near East, there begins this world of agricultural life and a whole new mythology. The earth goddess sending forth the fruits and all of that symbology comes along at that time. The period from there to the present emergence of a new world, what I would call a global mythology, dates from, let's say, 9,500 to BC to about 1,500 AD with the Renaissance, and this I would call the monumental period. The primitive, the monumental, and the global. So let me begin with the primitive world. Geographically, one can divide the primitive world into three great areas, and each has its own characteristic history and mythic forms. There's what I would call the circumpolar zone of the peoples in the north, and their landscape is largely one of relatively arid plains, and their principal world context is of ranging animals, and they are hunters. This is the realm of what may be called the Great Hunt. And the people there are living on animal food all the time. And the food is procured by the men. And so there is a very strong masculine emphasis. And where you get the male dominant, you have the problem of keeping his ego consoled about itself. And so there's a very strong ego-flattering emphasis. The killing of animals, killing, killing, killing all the time, particularly when animals are not regarded as very different from human beings, brings about a psychological problem. You're wading in blood. How are you going to defend the psyche from this? There is invented by the wonderful imagination of man, which can always defend itself, the idea, the theme, the motif, there is no death. The one who dies simply passes, as it were, through a wall into invisibility and may be recalled. This is what saves the psyche, so to say, that must continually be killing and eating, dressing in the skins of the animals killed, living in houses made of the skins of the animals killed. Furthermore, where you have hunters ranging after animals, you have collisions of tribes, and warcraft becomes a very important feature of the lifestyle of the hunting peoples of the circumpolar area. I'll come back to this a little later. Then we move to the next great geographical zone, which I would call the equatorial zone. You no longer have animals as the dominant feature of the world experience. You have plants. And animals, like human societies, are simply living in a plant world. And the image of the plant world becomes the guiding image for the understanding of life. Here, the societies tend to be more settled, larger. The food supply is somewhat more dependable than when you are ranging after animals all the time. The role of the male is greatly reduced. Anybody can pick a banana, and skill means very little. Whereas in the masculine world, it does make a great difference whether you can or cannot come back with the kill. Also, the killing in those primitive societies of the North was extremely dangerous work. When you think of the fact that men did not invent bows and arrows so that they could send a projectile into distance until about 15,000 BC and realize what the animals were that were being killed, mammoths, woolly rhinoceroses, and so forth, with these men going in with just spiked sticks and stones and finding ways to get falls, to build and dig falls so that the animals will fall in and they'll have a way to knock them out first, you're going to realize why, as I'm going to be showing later, some of the ordeals for initiating young men were absolutely terrific. Whereas in the equatorial zone, as I say, anyone can pick a banana, so the masculine prestige system was hardly developed at all. As the woman brings forth children, so the earth brings forth its abundance, and the female image rather than the masculine image became the dominant one. And remains the dominant one in this world of the plants and the planting societies. There is more of a stress on the social community in such groups than in the northern groups, where the stress actually is on individual prowess and prestige. Now, these people are not killing animals all the time, so you'd think they would have no particular crisis about death. However, what is observed in the vegetable world is that in what seems to be rot and decay from the decaying leaves and so forth, there comes life. So this fantastic and horrendous idea comes into being in the tropical zones that by increasing death, you increase life. Just as you fertilize a garden by throwing things in that will decay and die, so you fertilize the spiritual mystery by killing. And it is in these zones, the equatorial belt, that the rites of human sacrifice became developed simply beyond all belief. The sacrifices in the animal zone are a totally different sort, and human sacrifice is quite exceptional there. And I'll be talking about this in a couple of minutes. I just want to give the main contrast first. So we have this mythology of life coming from death, in contrast to the northern view of the dead person, individual, simply passing through a wall and coming back again. These are the two great mythologies of the latter days of the primitive world. Then when we go down still further into what I would call the austral zone, south of the equator, we come to a zone that is the original zone of the origins of mankind. Throughout the 20s and 30s, there were searches being made for the earliest remains of mankind. It was thought for a while that they might be found in Inner Asia. And then in the late 30s, just about the time of the beginning of the Second World War, They were found in South Africa, around Johannesburg and in that neighborhood. A wonderful set of skulls and bones of extremely primitive humanoid types who have been called Australopithecus, or the southern ape. These little creatures, there was a considerable variety, types, but basically these are rather refined bodied little creatures. The thing that makes them humanoid and not of a primate ape type is the character of the dent of the teeth. When you have an ape, the incisors are suddenly broken by the great canines, and then these teeth of the molars and premolars and molars go like that. Whereas in this, you have a jaw like this with a much more even set of teeth. That is, you are on the human side. Furthermore, these creatures are, some of them, were using weapons. They were using, some of the skulls were found to have a hole in them made by an object with a double knob at the end. And this object is a thigh bone with the double knob, and so bang. And those of you who've seen 2001 remember the ecstasy of that ape who found that he could use a thigh bone. That's taken right out of the scholarly works reporting these finds. Now, the dating for the Australopithecines of South Africa was placed about 600,000 BC. That was the situation around 1938, and it continued until the middle 60s, when this wonderful man, L.S.B. Leakey, L-E-A-K-E-Y, who has a nose for skulls and bones, working in the Olduvai Gorge in Kenya, I think it is, at Tanganyika, it's right at the border of these two, found the gorge is like this. It breaks open so that there are strata going back to about 1,800,000, that's a long, long time, my friends, BC. He finds skulls down there. He finds skulls of two types. One with teeth that are the teeth of a vegetarian. A person eating vegetable food, the teeth have to grind the cellulose and so forth, and they grind down faster than people eating meat, which is soft and nice. And then he called this vegetable eater Zinjanthropus. He found stone weapons. Now, these earliest stone weapons are very crude, large stones that have been shaped a little bit. They call them choppers or pebble stones. It was obvious that somebody was using tools at this time. For a while, he thought it was Zinjanthropus who was using tools, until in this same area, about the same date, he finds another character with the human-like teeth that are not worn down, a smaller character, and obviously this was the shaper of tools, and he had the nerve to call this man Homo, which means man in our modern sense, Homo habilis, able man, competent man, man already there. You get the sense from these finds, as well as from what we find in culture history later, that transformations of culture as well as of biological character take shape not in slow evolution, but in sudden metamorphoses. There's suddenly this is there and that's it. To return to the 2001, pedantically I differed from the way in which that creature became aware that he could use the bone. It's my conviction that he knew it right away, just as a child immediately born knows how to suck, doesn't have to become aware how to suck. If you have the organ to do it, you'll do it, and the organ comes first, and then the doing. This is a kind of theory that would be easily refuted. At any rate, we have these two types of early man, the vegetarian and the meat eater, or omnivore, who will eat anything. And the one from which we are descended, according to the doctor, is this. Zinjanthropus is of the Australopithecine type, Homo habilis something else. They are all roughly classified now by the archaeologists working in these materials as Australopithecines, but these distinctions have to be recognized. And look at that. Over a million years, these strange little hunting creatures in a world almost totally of animals wandering about. Point one, the first neighbors of man were animals and plants, and they it was that imprinted upon him the concept of other, and it was in relation to them that he had to play. And you know how it is when one meets another. One identifies in a certain sense. Watch a kid. He'd be anything he admires or bemarvels, he'd be imitating it in a couple of minutes. And so it is with early man. Man learns from his environment. Hunting man imitates animals. Plant man imitates plants in his culture. These are what Frobenius calls the paidoima, the guiding pedagogues of man. First animal, plant. Now, in all foraging societies, the men tend to be the hunters of the animals and the women the gatherers of plants. Man is, to the very present, animal-like. Woman, plant-like. And associated with the plant is the moon, which sends the dew that refreshes the plants, controls the tides of the womb and of the waters. Whereas the dominant lord of the animal world is the sun. These are assignments that appear very early in mythologies. Of course, we know nothing about the mythologies of these early Australopithecines, if they had any at all. I would think they probably had. Among the Australopithecine finds in South Africa, it was discovered that animal heads and tail bones were found together in caches, as it were. And it was thought that perhaps after the animal had been killed, the animal was skinned with head and tail and paws on the skin, and the skin then set up and revered as though there had been a head cult or a head-taking cult. But this is just a wild guess. So I'll leave the Australopithecines. The dating here is from, as I say, about 1,800,000 to about 600,000 BC. The next zone of discovery is in Java, where Java man, Pithecanthropus, was discovered. Now, this discovery was made already in the 80s of the last century, this was regarded as the missing link. You remember Darwin saying, all we have to find is the missing link between apes and men. Now we found no end of missing links, and the change is rather gradual. This Java man was found here, and this means that man had already covered the whole zone south of the Great Mountains. Shortly later, well, in the 20s, a similar skull type was found near Peking in, I guess around 1927 or something like that. So we have man up here into China. Similarly, in Europe, there have been found Heidelberg man, Swanscombe man, a whole series of skulls. Of course, there are many more finds in Europe than anywhere else because this is where people are looking for these things. And so we have man up here into Europe. Now, this great period of Pithecanthropus. Pithecanthropus is not a very attractive type. His skull capacity is somewhere around the 1,000 cubic centimeter mark. in this cave here, there were found skulls which he had taken and simply cracked open at the back and used as a soup bowl out of which to eat the raw brains. That seems to have been a delicacy of that period. There was no cooking. There's no evidence of the use of fire for cooking. However, in the caves of Sinanthropus, a Chinese man, we find our first evidence of the use of fire. The date would be somewhere between the 600,000 and let's say 300,000 mark. Already in this period, a division takes place in the culture finds right in North India. Eastward of North India, the tools, the stone tools, remain very, very primitive. Choppers and pebble tools. The reason may well be that it's in this area that such a plant as bamboo and pandanus prevails. And the bamboo furnishes weapons, furnishes all kinds of material, so also pandanus, and of course it decays, so we don't have any evidence of the development of the culture. At any rate, the stone tool situation remains very primitive on this side. However, fire is in use here. What was the fire used for? Now, the myths, the primitive myths about the discovery of fire, 9 times out of 10, will attribute the division between man and beast to that discovery. Before that, the ancestors were animal-like, and the animals were man-like. There was no real distinction. But then the animals stole fire from the fire hoarder, the fire keeper, and in a relay race passed the fire on. The animals that were burned by the fire became various animals, and the animal markings are described as effects of the burning, and the ones that became man held on to the fire. Now, you know, if you're lost in the woods and are afraid of animals, light a fire. They won't come within the fire range. The fire becomes the beginning of man's separation from the animals. The fire was not used for cooking, but I have another thought about fire. Fire and the hearth, that's the sacred place in all societies that have hearths at all. And the fire is usually understood to be a goddess. It's the fire goddess. For instance, in Hawaii, the goddess Pele, and Fujiyama. This is a goddess's name. Fuji is originally an Ainu word for the goddess of fire, and the hearth fire is revered as a goddess among the Ainus. There's nothing more fascinating than fire. Fire can be captured from volcanic rock. If you've ever been in a place where there has recently been a volcanic eruption, you find that the rock that looks as though it were cool isn't cool. And if you walk across it with sandals, your sandals will catch fire. The fire can just be taken from it. But the marvelous thing about fire is the more it is divided, the more it is. Other things fall in half when they're divided, and it's smaller and smaller and smaller, but fire is more and more and more as it spreads on. This is godlike. This is mythological. And fire is self-luminous. It's a subtle object. And since the fire hearth is the first home altar, I think it might well have been that just the fascination of fire might have caught the imagination of this funny lout here, the Sinanthropus, and the fires that we see may well have been his hearth. At any rate, so much for the eastern domain. Now the western domain, this whole domain here, including Africa, which is the motherland, and all through here we have the most beautiful development of stone tools in the form known as the hand axe. The interesting thing is that this hand axe develops in a similar way, in a similar sequence, over the whole field. Diffusion. Also, education. There is a communication system working here. Among the hand axes of the very early times are some as much as 2 feet long, these are flaked axes, symmetrically flaked. Now, an axe like that is of no practical use. It is already a ceremonial axe. And I think we can write the word ceremonial. This is pretty early. We have the continuity of development here. We have the evidence of ceremonial, communal rites, and a progressive technology, the flaked tools. Now, these periods that I have been talking about up to this date are known as the Lower Paleolithic. Lower. Suddenly, around 250,000 BC, there comes a new way of flaking axes. The core is held, and it's flaked off on two sides, and then a hard stroke, so that you get a flat side and a hard here. This is what's called the Mousterian type axe, and indicates the coming of a new kind of people, and these are then called Neanderthal man. These are the first people to move into the northern areas right under the glaciers. These are glacial periods. There are four glacial ages coming down and back, down and back. I won't bother you with the names of those Mindled, Riss, and the Vim. These Neanderthalers, sturdy, heavy-boned, probably covered with a good pelt of hair, moved into the areas close to the glaciers. Why? Because that's where the animals were enormously abundant. And there begins what I call the period of the Great Hunt. These great plains are absolutely animal plains, no vegetable life to talk about. And it's in this period, in these areas, that we have our first positive evidence of religious beliefs. And this positive evidence is in burials. Not everybody was buried. In many cultures, most people are simply thrown to the hyenas or vultures. But here we have distinct burials with grave gear. That is to say, the notion of an afterlife is right there. A second type of discovery, I'm going to name only these two, a second type of discovery associated with Neanderthal men are sanctuaries of cave bear skulls. These were discovered in the 20s. The 20s was a great period for archaeological breakthroughs. In a couple of caves in the high Alps, almost to the snow line, and what certainly must have been under the snow line during the Vim. Consequently, people could have entered them only before that glaciation, which means before 200,000 BC. There were found caches of cave bear skulls, some of them surrounded by little rings of stones, one of them with the leg bones of the bear in the bear's mouth, a couple with leg bones pushed through the eye sockets as though to prevent the evil eye of the killed animal from working. And here we get the worship of the animal master, which is a basic theme of all hunting mythologies. That master of the animals, who is at the gate, so to say, through which the animals come into the plains to be killed, who must be propitiated by some kind of rite so that he will let the animals through. Now, the animal master changes in character in different cultural contexts, but he plays the same role, whether it is the master buffalo, or the master beaver, or the master cave bear, or the master whatnot. Let me tell you a little American Indian myth from the Blackfoot Indians, which tell us something about the animal master and his character. This, I think, is a rather charming myth. It appears in George Bird Grinnell's books on Blackfoot Lodge Tales. The one of the techniques for gaining plenty of meat that the American Indians used, and that was used also in the great hunt of ancient Paleolithic Asia, was to drive an animal herd, scare an animal herd, over the edge of a precipice. A precipice would be found, which would be good for this kind of work. Then the herd would be sort of herded toward that, and they'd fall over. This was called an animal fall. Well, in the case of this particular story, the animals would not go over the fall. They would go to it and then break off, and they were getting no, the tribe was getting no buffalo, and they thought they might have to starve. Winter was coming on, and there was no meat, no food. Get a sense of the precarious lives of these early societies. One morning, a young girl gets up early, goes to the well to get water for the family breakfast or whatnot, and she sees a herd right up there, right on the edge. And she says, "Oh, if you would only jump over the cliff, I would marry one of you." Well, what do you know? Over they came, the whole thing like a storm, and breaking their backs and groaning and falling down, and one great big bucko comes over and he says, "Okay, girlie, fine." Oh, she says, "Oh, no." And, you know, surprise, the whole thing is surprising. And he said, "But look, this was the, here are all my relatives and friends smashed up here, and you're backing down like this, you come on." You never know when you're reading these stories whether it's an animal or a human being. This is the semi-animal, semi-human. Now, he was the shaman of that whole thing, and it was he who sent them over. That's the animal master. He's shamanistic. So he runs off with the girl. Well, the family wakes up a little later, and they say, "Well, where's Minnehaha?" You know, and you know how Indians are, though. They just look at the footprints, and you get the whole story. So Dad goes out, and he looks at the footprints, and he sort of, he sees that buffalo, and he sees all the dead buffalo, and he gets the point. So he goes in, puts on his walking moccasins and gets his bow and arrow and all that kind of stuff, and he starts out after Minnehaha, and he's sniffing his way along, and he comes to a buffalo wallow. Now that's a nice dusty place with some water nearby where the buffalo like to roll around and get the fleas off and things like that. And this is buffalo country, so he sits down and tries to think up a plan of campaign. And while he's sitting there, a magpie comes. Now, magpies are wonderful, smart birds, and they play the role of trickster, hero, and shaman bird. So he says to the magpie, "Have you seen my daughter around here? She ran off with a buffalo." And the magpie says, "Well, there's a herd just down the way there, and I saw a young girl there. She's probably your daughter." "Well," says the father, "will you just tell her that her father is here?" And the magpie says, "Okay, I'll do that." So the magpie goes over, and he pretends to be picking around near the girl. He moves up to her, and he says, "Your father's over there by the wall." And and she says, "Oh, dear, this is terrible. You tell him to wait. This is very dangerous. I'll try to get in touch with him." So back goes the magpie with the message. Now, the old buffalo is asleep, as buffaloes usually are, and she's sitting there doing her knitting or whatnot with all these sleeping buffaloes. And then the old boy wakes up. He says, "Go over to the well and get me some water." Bing! And he busts off a horn, hands it to her, and she goes with the buffalo horn to get a bit of water. So she goes and she says, "Daddy, this is real dangerous. Those fellows are going to kill you." He says, "Come on, I don't want you with all those buffaloes." Well, she says, "You wait a minute, I'll work this thing out. This is not going to be easy." So she goes back with the buffalo horn full of water, and the old man takes it, and he goes, and he says, "Fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell the blood of an Indian," something like that. And and she says, "Nothing of the kind." It's the same mythology, that's why I'm using these. And she's very nervous, but he lets out a buffalo roar. All the buffaloes wake up, and now it's time to go on the war path, so they all start doing a buffalo dance. She looks on in amazement. And then they go over to the buffalo wallow and they dance Daddy to death. They just trample him down so there's no Daddy left, and Minnehaha is crying there. So the old buffalo looks at her and he says, "So you're sad, you're crying, your daddy's dead. But think of all our relatives, dead, 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 all over the place as a result of the works of your tribe." Well, she says, "Oh, but he's my daddy, and I do want him back." Well, says the buffalo, and here's the beginning of a very important theme, "If you can bring your daddy back to life, I'll let you and him go. So she says to the magpie, do you think you could find a little bit of daddy over there? Just any little bit of bone would be okay. And the magpie goes and picks around, and he does indeed find one of the vertebrae and brings it to the girl. Now what she does is put that vertebra down, put her blanket over it, and start singing a magical song. This is this idea, there is no death now, if you perform the rites properly. She presently brings it about that there is daddy lying there under the blanket. She lifts the blanket, thinks he's there, all right, but he isn't living yet. So she goes on with the song, and presently the blanket moves and up sits daddy. Well, all the buffalo are very much exercised about this and very much excited about it. And they say to her, why don't you do this for us? And so they said, here's the way to do it now. We get the idea. And they taught the buffalo dance to the girl and her father. And they went back as the messengers of this covenant with the animals. This is the basic myth of hunting cultures. A covenant between the human society and the animal society, based on the principle that the animals will offer their bodies, provided a ritual is performed, returning their blood to the source, mother soil, from which they will be born again. The same animals come back. They're not different animals. They're the same animals, just as the same daddy came back. If the proper rite is performed, they can give their body time and time and time again. So that when one is being initiated into the lore of the hunt, this lore includes not only how to use weapons, string a bow and let an arrow fly, but also how to perform the rite that will make it, bring it about that there should be animals present. And any failure of animal herds to appear is attributed to a failure of some kind in the rites. The Buffalo Society of the Blackfeet Indians were the protectors of this ritual. And we have paintings by Catlin and so forth of these buffalo dances, where the dancers wear buffalo heads imitating the buffalo in this little dialogue. This is a basic hunting rite, the notion of animal masters and the notion of the covenant. The notion also of adventurers and adventures through whom or through which the rite is brought from the animal world. It's given by the animals themselves. This myth seems to me a very important one. Now let me bring up one more thing in connection with this. On the American plains in the late 19th century, 1880, something like that, the buffalo were systematically killed off by Buffalo Bill and so forth. These were buffalo hunting scouts that were sent out to clear out the buffalo herds. The railroad way had been built across the plains, and buffalo herds could not be allowed to get on the tracks. This would all be very dangerous. Furthermore, by killing off the buffalo, you were causing the Indians to lose their food supply, and they'd have to go onto the reservations to receive handouts. When I was a kid, the world was full of buffalo blankets. The buffalo were simply killed and skinned and the pelts taken and sold wholesale, you might say. Thousands and thousands. Whenever we'd go for a sleigh ride, there'd be a buffalo blanket to put over your knees. As a result of this, the center of the social mythology of the Indians was erased. In this mythology, the whole psyche is brought out, and one is related to his own unconscious through the images of one's society. The society is the mirror through which you keep in touch with your own unconscious. That's broken. So you have a dissociation. This is the wasteland motif again, in a quite specific context. And it was following that that the ecstasy cults became rampant over the American plains. It was following that extermination of the buffalo, the breaking of the social religious context, that peyote, the mescaline cult, came, eating peyote buttons and stirring up the images, the psychedelic movement. It seems to me that this is a perfectly analogous case to that of the contemporary moment, where the socially provided mythology has failed. There is a dissociation, a wasteland situation, so one turns inward to find those source powers. One can also show that in primitive societies, the mythological imagery is announced by shamans from their trance experiences. They go into their unconscious, which is essentially the unconscious of their neighbors, because everyone is living in a mythogenetic zone, a zone where the same influences are striking. Some people have a talent for going down, others don't. The ones who do are the shamans. The crisis comes, the shaman crisis, usually in early adolescence. A boy or a girl, where you have shamanism, males or females play the role, has a whole system of visions. Now here I've given what I think might be called the main motifs of the hunting mythologies. The vision, which supports everybody's life, comes primarily from the shamans, but everybody has some degree of visionary experience. Among the American Indians, where the vision became democratized, so to say, the puberty rites for young boys consisted in daddy bringing the young boy out into a scary place in the forest, leaving him there for 4 days to fast with a little fire to keep the animals away, and to invoke a vision. And the vision that would come to him would be his familiar. He wouldn't be able to predict in what form the vision would come, but this dream vision would announce to the boy what his career was to be, whether he was to be a great warrior, a great hunter, a great chieftain, a great shaman. And the boy would then be told by the vision what kind of fetish to fashion for himself, a medicine bag in which certain little things were put, special types of stone that he would see, or part of a bird or something like this, which then would be his reminder, his clue to his own vision. This is the counterpart of the Hindu mantra, reciting a certain syllable or so, you start your vision system going again. But here would be a little bag which you contemplate. This would then determine the boy's character, and he would bring this wisdom of his into the village. If later on he found he was lacking power, he would go to have another vision and might or might not have it. In the course of invoking visions or partaking of the communal rites, there were the most amazing sacrifices among the American Indians of finger joints. Catlin has described one of the most fantastic ordeals of young men being prepared for their adulthood, the crisis of transition from boyhood to adulthood. A great medicine lodge with great beams across it and ropes hanging down with great wooden skewers or spikes tied to the ropes. And perhaps you've seen this picture. The skewers are put through the pectoral muscles or the back muscles, and the boys are hauled up by these ropes, so they're hanging by these things through their muscles, put through the muscles of the legs and arms, and buffalo skulls hung on, and then people underneath with poles would hit these skulls until they tore out. The boys would be spun around until the things tore out, and they would faint, of course, and the idea was to learn to rest on Wakon Tanka, or whatever name would be given for the cosmic power, and give up yourself. And a boy who was not capable of this was not capable of the ordeals of manhood in such a culture. They were all put through this. And then after, sometimes with the skull still hanging after they'd been knocked down, they go up to a chopping block, and one after another, the fingers are chopped off their hands, the fingers that are unnecessary for handling a bow and arrow, the only fingers left being this. The ordeals were terrific. These kids had to live a life that was no easy one. Also, in this culture, the celebration of the warrior was a kind of festival celebration. One received more acclaim for what is called counting coup than for killing an enemy. When you have a bow and arrow, you can kill an enemy at a distance. But those sticks that you see the old fellows carrying with feathers on them and so forth are coup sticks, C-O-U-P in French. An enemy is shot down, and then all the members of the opposing force try to go in and touch that shot down man with this stick. That's called counting coup. And every time you've had the nerve to do that with the firepower of the other coming whiz, whiz, whiz all around you, you can add a feather to your cap. Another type of fighter is a person who belongs to what is called the dog society. Such people would have a belt around them with a long strap and a stick at the end of it. They'd stick that stick in the ground in a battle, and then they would never move from that stick, no matter what happened. They could die defending themselves this way. And then the final test of the hero: if he is captured, he will be tortured, and this is a normal ordeal, and the torturing was pretty exquisite, and he must be smiling and make believe and disdainful of those trying to break him up. This is the development of the kind of stamina that the great hunt demands, and it's a totally different thing from what I'll be talking about next, namely the tropical style. Well, all of this is a development in our American Indian plains of motifs of the great hunt, of which we have a couple of clues. There is no death, the animal master, and we know that the hunt there was terrific. After the Vrim glaciation retreats from Europe, there comes about the period that we call the Cro-Magnon man. And Cro-Magnon is definitely human in our sense. The date for the end of the Vrim is about 40,000 BC. And this is the period of the great caves of the Dordogne and Cantabrian mountains of northern Spain and the Pyrenees. I advise everybody who goes to France or to Spain to pay a visit to those caves. This is one of the most, it's very easy to do. They're completely accessible. And this is one of the most thrilling experiences you can have. Unfortunately, one of the most spectacular, that at Lascaux, is now barred to multitudes because the paintings were beginning to deteriorate as a result of the breath. The mosses and things were forming over them. But I was there, fortunately for me, before that, and I can tell you that you've never seen anything like it. One stops, let's say, at Chartres Cathedral on the way down and sees the whole pantheon in anthropomorphic form, and then one goes into the cave and here it is in teriomorphic form, these prodigious bulls and swimming deer and one thing after another. The whole thing is right there, and you're in the cave, and where are you? You're in the womb of the earth where the ideas come from that are reborn every year if you'll send the vitalizing blood back. This is the source for these animal powers. Now, in the first of these caves to be discovered was Altamira in the Cantabrian hills of Spain. It was on an estate. This was discovered around 1875, something like that, by the baron whose estate that was. It's a rather cute story. He was in there rummaging around for arrowheads and things like that. He'd been stimulated by an exhibit in Paris to think, well, gee, I have a cave in my estate. Why don't I just go? So Sundays he would go, and his little daughter Maria would go with him. Now, she was a tiny little thing, like some of these little tots around here, and she could wander under low ledges. So she's wandering around the cave as far as Daddy will let her go, and she wanders under one of the ledges and looks up, and she cries out, "Toros, toros, bulls, bulls." And he looks, my God, there they are. This was the first discovery of the art of the caves, and every one of the anthropological societies rejected the find as a fake, saying that an artist had visited this baron and he'd had them done. They didn't even have the wit to test the paint to see if you could buy it in any of the paint stores of Paris. They didn't even have the wit to look at the work that was being done in Paris and see what artist was doing that kind of thing. This poor man died in disgrace. And it wasn't until the Abbé Breuil, who was a young anthropologist at that time, found similar paintings in France, La Belle France, from which La Civilisation comes, that these things were given credit. And then Breuil and his master, who had been the master having been responsible for rejecting these finds, they go hat in hand, ashamed, back to Altamira, where Marie is now a matron. This is about 1895. She's 20 years old or so. She's in her late 20s. And they say, we beg your pardon. And they say, right, we see that cave. Oh, she said, we found a lot of others since. And they said, well, why didn't you let us know? She said, it seems you didn't want to know. So this is it. Well, when you go to Altamira now, as I say, it was only a little girl who could get under there. They've dug down so that you can walk in, and they've left the original level on the sides of the places where you walk, and you can lie back, and in Altamira, the animals are above there, and they seem like constellations. Now, let me tell you the little myth and rite that has been observed, which interprets these. It was Frobenius in Africa, one of the greatest Africa anthropologists the world has known. He died just about the time the Second World War began, about 1940. He was in the Congo area with an anthropological safari, and they required meat. Their party had been joined by three pygmies. Now, the pygmies are a vestigial hunting people, and they are great hunters. So Frobenius said to these three tiny little people, would you go get us a gazelle or something like that for our larder? We need it. Well, they looked utterly shocked that he should have thought they'd be able to go out, shoot a gazelle, and bring it to him. And he said, well, what's the matter? They said, well, we have to perform a rite first, and we can't bring you anything until tomorrow. While the party was going on, Frobenius remained behind, hidden, to watch what the rite was. This was his business, and he was going to find out about it. What happened was this. They went up on the top of a hill with a bald top nearby, a small hill. They cleaned off the weeds and the grass and all, smoothed down a certain little area, and on it they drew the picture of the gazelle that they were going to shoot. This was done in the evening. Then, before dawn the next morning, they went to that hill, and the woman was standing, and one of the men standing, and the other man was standing over here with his bow and arrow, eastward of the gazelle. And the first beam of the sun that struck that gazelle, he let go simultaneously his arrow, as though it were on the sunbeam, and the arrow struck the animal in the neck. And the woman raised her arms with a cry, and then they went out and hunted that and brought back a gazelle, which had been shot in the neck just that way. And then they asked Frobenius for a cup of the blood of the gazelle and some of the fur. Next morning, they're up there on that hill again, and at the moment of the sunrise, they pour the blood and throw the fur on the animal and erase the animal. It's the sun that killed the animal. In other words, they were acting not as individual avid creatures, but as agents of a cosmic process. The sun rises and extinguishes the stars. The flocks, the grays in the heavens are the animal herds, the herbivorous herds. The sun is the lion who pounces on the animal's necks. And if you look at some of the other figures on these early Paleolithic caves and rock walls, particularly in Africa, the ones I'm speaking of now, you will see the lion jumping on the animal's neck, and the warrior is identified with the solar beam. As I said earlier, the sun is associated with the warrior, the moon with the woman, and the hunter. Well, these caves are fantastic, and I'll tell you of just one more. The great cave in the Pyrenees, known as Trois Frères. In the Trois Frères cave, which is found by three brothers, that's why it's called, their dog fell into a hole, they went down, and oh my gosh, look what's here, pop. So they sent for daddy and this great, great cave. On the wall is the dancing shaman, whom you've probably seen, with antlers, with owl-like eyes, with a shaman beard, with a lion chest and paws, with human legs and the tail of a horse or wolf. And this combination creature which is a costume that shamans still wear in various parts of the world, is in a dancing posture. A dance looks very much like a cakewalk dance, actually. And his eyes are staring at a little hole across the cave. That hole is this end of a lava tube, which is about 2 feet in diameter, and formerly was the only way to get into that cave. And it's about 50 yards long. And one little party of anthropologists took it upon themselves to crawl through that cave, what nerve, to see how it felt and all. And the claustrophobia and the sense of fear is terrific. Obviously, since that was the only way into the cave, that's how people got in the cave, who put the figures there. And the likelihood is that it symbolized the second birth, as though this were the birth canal, and the youngsters sent through at the age of 14 or 15 or something like that come out in this other cave where there would be flickering wick lights. This is the astonishing thing to realize. There were no electric lights. There were no fire lights. There were just little wick lights in which controlled the vision of these great men. And the boys have come into the field of the animal master, part human, part man, and that is the imprint which transforms in their experience the imprint of the father image and so forth and so on. Well, let me get on then to this this planning situation. This period of the late Paleolithic, the lower, the Neanderthal is called the middle Paleolithic, and the Cro-Magnon is called the upper Paleolithic. There are a great many very complicated biological questions associated with this appearance of the Cro-Magnon man. This is called Homo sapiens sapiens. Are all of the contemporary sapiens races descended from this same stock? If so, the biological evolution is extremely rapid. Now, this problem is brought up by Carlton Coon, C-O-O-N, in his very important big work, The Origin of Races. And it's an extremely controversial matter as to whether the present races all descend from Cro-Magnon, that is to say, are only 40,000 years, have had only 40,000 years of evolution from a single core, or whether the evolutions are from separate upper Paleolithic racial stocks, all of which, of course, would have been have descended ultimately from the same humanoid stock. That's a how far back do the racial relationships reach? The normal anthropological decision has been that they have all descended from the Cro-Magnon base, but Kuhn brings this into serious question, and that's an argument that's still going on. One way or other, it's not of physical races that I'm going to be talking or have been talking. I'm talking of the cultural context, which can include peoples of quite various race. The physical races are all mixed up from way, way back. Now, this period of the Cro-Magnon continues to about 15,000 BC, when there comes a new kind of culture formed largely from the equatorial base, known as the Mesolithic, or in-between Stone Age, also called the Microlithic, or Little Stone Age, because there are a lot of little points. This means, and we know from the engravings on rock walls, that the bow and arrow has been invented. At this period, the bow and arrow and the first domesticate appear in our cave art, the dog. The dog has been with us since about 15,000 BC, as far as we know. Now, there's a great question comes up now. What is the source of this Mesolithic and Microlithic? I spoke earlier of the fact that if the culture material is made of perishable material, it's almost impossible for the anthropologist to document it. Frobenius, this Africa anthropologist of whom I have already spoken, used the term the invisible counterplayer to represent the culture forms of that tropical zone, which can very well have intruded suddenly into the stone-documented areas and brought about the sudden transformations that we observe. He asks whether these important transformations are not evidence of influences from this tropical zone, where the culture materials are of perishable material rather than stone. The arts of the northern people are generally two-dimensional, engraving, rock paintings, and so forth. The arts, the plastic arts of the tropical people are generally three-dimensional. This is the prime zone of sculpture. And you'll remember at the end of the 19th century when the artists of Paris began to get the message of Congolese sculpture and the sculpture from West Africa, a new sense of the plastic experience. The classical sculpture of Greece, you might say, are four planes. One looks at this side, that side, the other side, and the other. They may be rounded off, but it is conceived from the four planes, whereas the African sculpture is plastic in a new way. One of the secrets is this, that in the Greek sculpture, the plane, the broadest plane, is rather far forward, so that your eye plane stops about here. Whereas in these African things, if you look, it's like an egg. The plane of vision is here, so that you get a more plastic experience. Also, there's a wonderful playfulness in the sculpture here. It is mythologically inspired rather than visually inspired, and you get a wonderful abstraction and virtuosity of transformation. This whole culture world of the tropics is yet to be explored. Frobenius, I'm going to continue to talk about him a little bit, speaks of two great pendulations of culture. One which he calls the West to East pendulation. The Paleolithic forms, man originating in the African area and early developing in the European area, moving on foot eastward to Eastern Asia. Then in Southeast Asia, he suggests the Great Transformation. He calls this the hiatus in culture because we have hardly any documentation. Then an east-west pendulation, people coming back into the eastward zones, sailing boats and planting crops. In Frobenius's view, the invention of planting would have taken place somewhere in Southeast Asia. You might put Thailand as the likely center. According to most modern anthropologists and archaeologists, the credit is given to Southwest Asia, the Near East. I read in the paper in the Honolulu Star Bulletin just about a week ago that the University of Hawaii has sent a team to northern Thailand to excavate, and they have begun to find evidence that Frobenius anticipated as early as 1898, namely of the very early planting here. Then there's a man who used to be at the University of California, and I don't know where he is now, Carl Sauer, S-A-U-E-R, who has actually intuited diffusions from that area in all directions. Let me tell you what the animals are that would have come from here. The domesticated dog, the domesticated pig, and the domesticated chicken, and the domesticated duck. The chicken, the rooster that crows and wakes the dawn all over the world now, is a Southeast Asian animal. And according to Carl Sauer, the lice and ticks on European pigs are of a Southeast Asian breed. So the domesticated pig and the domesticated dog and the domesticated chicken may well have come from here, along with root crops, things like taro, for the potato, the yam, and so forth. When the agriculture reaches northern zones, there is a shift from root crops to seed crops, of which wheat and rice and barley and oats are the principal examples. The early Neolithic or New Stone Age planting cultures then are based in our northern world, in China as well, on seed crops. Now let me say something about the mythology of these areas. As I've said, it is the woman's world. The women gather the fruits, the women give birth to the children, the women take care of the house, the women build the houses. What are the men doing? They are having inferiority complex problems. How do they solve it? Well, men have the advantage of a certain playful imagination. There's simply no doubt about it. Many women have remarked to me what fun men manage to have together. So they invented this very important culture phenomenon, the man's secret society, where no women are allowed. And these men with the inferiority complex in the Southeast Asian zone invent the men's magical house and its rites. Now let me give you an example of the rites practiced in the Melanesian men's secret societies. This is the realm of spiritual life as opposed to mere, material life and physical reproduction. This is spiritual reproduction. We're on the beginnings of Plato's Symposium here, where a distinction is made between the heavenly Venus and the earthly Venus, and heavenly love, which is boy love, pederasty, and earthly love, which is heterosexual, gives birth only to children. The other gives birth to artworks. But the principal activity, spiritual activity, in these men's cults is the cultivation and raising of pigs, male pigs. The upper canines are knocked out, and the lower canines, or tusks, then are free to grow without interference. And they grow around in a loop, naturally, which then curves right back and starts back through the jaw. Now, the animal's in considerable pain at this point, so it loses weight and becomes a truly spiritual being, no extra matter or flesh. The idea is to get that loop to go around three times. When it's gone around three times, you've got a real three-looper, and this is a very valuable possession. It's valuable for a number of reasons. One reason is that at every important stage in the development of that tusk, the owner of the pig has to sacrifice hundreds of other pigs. So he becomes worth hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pigs as this thing goes round and round and round. And at each great ceremonial, the man could take a new name until he becomes a kind of 32nd degree mason, finally, with the three loops, and his name would be something like He Who Walks on Clouds, and he's allowed in ceremonials to stand with his arms going like this, as though he were a solar hawk. Well, you get the whole business of masonry and the achievement of spiritual stature. Women are out on this. They're not in the thing at all. And here's a very important point. A parody mythology is intentionally invented to frighten the women. They are told that what is going on in the men's clubs is something that isn't going on there at all. And then there are certain masquerades that are put on just for their use to frighten them so that they won't be nosy about this and to keep them where they belong. Now when a man dies, the pig goes with him as the sop to Cerberus. He is going to be stopped on the way to the fire mountain by the goddess of the fire mountain, who will draw a labyrinth design and erase half of it as he approaches. He must know the other part of the labyrinth. He must be able to reconstruct the labyrinth. That is what he has been taught in the men's secret society. The men's secret society tells you how to gain immortal life through knowing the secrets of the underworld. The labyrinth is erased. Through his knowledge, he reconstructs it. He gives his pig, which is his own alter ego, he is identical with it. It is the surrogate offering. It is the crucified redeemer. It is the first animal sacrifice in these culture zones. In the rites of sacrifice after his pig gets to be a three-looper, he may actually offer human sacrifices as well. And the human being sacrificed would have been little boys that he had himself begotten on women who were not his wife, whom he raised, as he would raise pigs, as offerings to enhance the value of his big three-looper. So the first great vicarious sacrifice, who dies for us so that we may be released and may pass through the purgatorial labyrinth to eternal life, was the pig, the rites for whom survive in the Melanesian world very, very handsomely. The other system of rites has to do with the renewal of a primordial event. Now let me tell you this primordial myth, which one finds throughout the tropical zone, and you may recognize some of its details. There was a time when there was no time, when people and plants and animals could not be distinguished from each other. These are called in the Melanesian area the Dimak, or we might call them the eternal ones of the dream, the ancestors. One of these ancestors was killed, was cut up. The parts were buried, and from the buried parts there grew the food plants on which people live. Simultaneously with this coming of death into the world, that's the coming of death, the beginning of time, the sexes were separated from each other and the sexual organs appeared and the act of begetting became possible. So that simultaneously with death, there came birth and there came eating. In other words, the world as we knew it, as we know it, came into being with the mythological event of a killing. In order to refresh the world, that event is repeated, is imitated in rites. This kind of rite is a renewal, a reenactment of the primordial event on which all life depends. It is enacted visually, in fact, before the eyes of the community, everybody participating in it. There is a very fine work by a man named Paul Wirtz, a Swiss anthropologist, describing the rites of the Marind Anim of West New Guinea, who are now in the hands of the Indonesian nation, let's call it. These rites are as follows. At the time of the boys' initiations, they are about to become little adults. At the end, there are 3 days of general Saturnalian sexual license in which the boys do not participate. In these initiations, there will be about half a dozen or seven or eight youngsters being initiated. The last night, the dance ground is swept nice and clean. The great big split log drums are being beaten. You know that type of drum with the log, a hollow log, and the resonation. Those are the mouths of the ancestral spirits, and the sound of the drums is the sound of the ancestral voices. Everybody is dancing. There is, at the side, a great lean-to of heavy logs, one end on the ground, the other end supported by a crossbeam that is itself supported by two uprights. A girl comes in, beautifully arrayed, with a great headdress of pandanus leaves and so forth, looking like one of the ancestral spirits. She lies down in that place under the lean-to of heavy logs, and one by one, the initiated boys has intercourse with her in his first official sexual experience. The last boy who has been selected for this as being the most beautiful of all, just as she has been selected as the most beautiful of all, when he is with her, the supports are withdrawn, and when they are in full embrace, the logs drop and they are immediately killed. This is the reuniting of death and sex. Kama, Mara, whom I've talked about right along. Then they are dragged out, cut up, roasted, and consumed in a sacramental meal. This is the renewal of the mystery, to let you know that what you eat when you eat is the body of the God. The God has sacrificed himself for you. Now this is to be done with joy, with gratitude, everybody participating as members of this world community which lives on death. This is the monstrous thing that I mentioned earlier, which is made vivid before the eyes of everybody in order that they may know what life is. Furthermore, since there must be death before there is life, one of the chief rites, particularly in the southeastern sphere of this tropical zone, is the rite of the head hunt. A young man, before he can marry and beget life, must take life. And this is no heroic job, as the hunting of and the warcraft of the northern Indians and the plains people. This is a secret, hidden thing. He will hide in the great leaves with his blowgun and poisoned dart. And when a neighbor, person from a neighboring tribe, a male, goes past, he will send that arrow at him, and the man is about to be dead. Then he will go, the man knows the game, he's playing the game too now that he's in it, and ask the man's name, take the man's name, take the man's head, and come back with that. That is the seed of the child he's going to beget. And that head will be present at his marriage ceremony. The head is there and is being fed as a guest with everybody else, treated with honor and so forth. You might say, before a man can get married, please excuse, he must get a head. The head is the sign of his having brought death into the world so that he can now beget. And there again is an imitation of the rite. You cannot explain the dawn of human societies in economic terms at all. The whole thing is mythologically inspired, and when the myth dies, so does the culture. This is a wonderful game. It's a game that involves horror and all, but that is the game of the southern people. One can trace this myth through all of the planting, early planting cultures. Out in Polynesia, there are myths. The origin of the coconut, it is the myth of a great conger eel who falls in love with a girl. Often the story, and it appears in most of the islands, is of a girl who finds a certain pool, these lovely pools at the foot of a waterfall in which she likes to bathe. The Polynesian islands are full of such. And there's a strange eel there that, when she's bathing, likes to come just scrape against your leg and go away, and scrape against your leg and go away. And one fine day, he turns into a beautiful youth, and there you are, kind of Cupid Psyche sort of thing. And after a number of nights of delight, he tells her, next time I come, I shall turn back into my conger eel form, and you must cut off my head and bury it. And indeed, she, unwillingly, but nevertheless constrained to do so, cuts off his head and buries it, and from that there grows the coconut tree, which is the basic food tree, and looking at the coconut tree, you can see the heads. The coconut looks like that head, and you can buy coconuts that have been made into little people's heads. Now I ask you, holding that thought in mind, to think of the medieval story of the crucifixion. The hill on which the cross is placed is called the Hill of Golgotha, or the Hill of Calvary, both words meaning skull, one in Aramaic and the other in Latin, the skull. The cross grows, or is placed, above the skull. Whose skull is it? It is said to be Adam's skull. So Christ, the fruit of the tree, who is called the second Adam, offered on the tree, his blood falls and redeems that skull. this is an image that is hardly different from that of the coconut tree which grew from the skull of the serpent lord. Now in all these mythologies of the land, of the planting, the serpent represents, as I've already said here, that earthbound spiritual energy which is incarnate in us all. The serpent figure, the earliest serpent figure in this kind of context that we know, appears on a little buckle of mammoth bone that was found in a child's grave in the neighborhood of Lake Baikal in eastern Siberia from about 18,000 BC. It is the animal of rebirth. Through its death comes birth, and so the serpent lord. One of the most interesting ancient Sumerian finds is a libation vase dating from 2000 BC, the vase of King Gudea of Lagash, which is one of the great early Sumerian cities. This is late Sumer now, 2000 BC. There is a vase, a libation vase, showing a staff with two serpents. That's the yoga Sushumna that I spoke of. This serpent, we know his name. His name is Ningishzida. Now think of Eve in the garden with the tree and the serpent who is cursed and who knows the wisdom of the underworld and of immortal life. Look in the art of Gupta India. One sees all over the place what are called the Naga Rajas, serpent kings. They're beautiful, graceful youths with a kind of hood or halo of five or seven cobra hoods. These are the serpent kings, and they hold in one hand the vase of immortal elixir, and in the other the plant, the lotus usually. And this is the serpent that said to Eve, eat of the fruit. Do you remember the story of Tiresias that Ovid tells? Tiresias was walking in the forest with his staff, and he came upon two enormous serpents copulating, and he placed his staff between them to push them apart, and was himself transformed into a woman. He had hit the point that transcends the pairs of opposites, and himself had flashed through. So he lived for 7 years, this is an eon of time, as a woman. And walking in the woods one day, he saw two enormous serpents copulating, and she put her staff between them and was turned back into a man. Now Zeus and Hera, his wife, were arguing in heaven one day about who enjoys sexual congress the more, the male or the female. And of course, neither could judge. And they said, well, let's send for Tiresias, he should know. So they do indeed send for Tiresias, and Tiresias answers promptly, the woman. Well, Hera took this badly for some reason that I can't possibly work out, but she was so angry at this that she struck Tiresias blind. And Zeus then, in congratulation, gave him the gift of prophecy. So this is the story of Tiresias, that one who is the male-female, and in being such, has gone back, so to say, out of the world of mere waking consciousness into the world of dream consciousness, and while his two eyes don't work, because he's no longer in touch with the place, with the sphere and experience of pairs of opposites, his middle eye, that uniting eye, that transcendent eye, does. And when Odysseus came to Circe's isle and had that little adventure with her, she introduced him to the underworld, and he went down into the underworld, and the underworld was full of shadows, shadowy spooks. That's to say, the people who had lived only in terms of one level of consciousness, masculine or feminine, were but shadows, but half people. But there was one substantial presence there, namely Tiresias. And it was from Tiresias that Odysseus learned his destiny. I must say, when you look at a drawing of a yogi with the Sushumna and the Ida and Pingala crossing seven times, and then look at the seal of Gudea of Lagash, you really do get a certain impression of a universality of experience with the number seven and the two serpents. These two serpents are one serpent. That's the serpent that can be and is male and female split in half. So Adam, with Eve drawn from his ribs, is that the, you might say, the anthropomorphic aspect of that serpent who became two. And then that one spirit I spoke of who said, I, and became two. All of that is right in this darn business. So that in yoga, when one's bringing the energies of these two serpents together at the base of the spine, uniting them and then carrying it up to the center, one is simply reuniting the pairs of opposites of the two serpents indicated in the seal of Gudea of Lagash. This is the serpent of the garden. He was there 5,000 years at least before Yahweh came along. Whenever one of the gods of the patriarchal system arrives, he has to go to work to reduce these fellows. We know of Apollo fighting the lord of the Delian oracle, and we hear of Yahweh crushing the serpent. And just as the Sibyl of Delos was the human female vehicle of the wisdom of the Python, so was Eve the human vehicle of the wisdom of the serpent. But the patriarchal culture puts them down. So that's what will be this afternoon's talk. So thank you.